Chapter 5. The Red River, April 1864. When the letter was out of my hand, the waiting did not end. That is one thing a man learns in the army. An order may come, and still there is waiting. A march may be expected, and still a man sits with his haversack packed. A boat may be said to leave tomorrow, and tomorrow may spend half its strength becoming another day. The letter I had written to Janet carried what I could send ahead of me. My health, my love, the news of Robert, the death of Peter LaFlower, the word that I expected to go up Red River. Then the paper went its way by the uncertain roads of war, and I remained in camp with the men who were to move. The camp of distribution outside New Orleans had no settled life in it. It was made for sorting men, not keeping them. Soldiers came there from hospitals, from detached service, from parole, from replacement drafts, from all the broken paths by which an army loses and recovers its parts. Every man asked after his regiment. Every man listened for his name. The camp had the feel of a depot more than a home, but the things men did there were still the things men do wherever they are held. Cook, mend, wash, drill, pray, grumble, write, sleep, wake, and ask the same questions again. I had sent my overcoat home because Louisiana had no use for such a load. There were six of us who put our overcoats in a box, and it was no small bother getting it sent by express to Portage. A northern overcoat that had been comfort in winter would be a killing weight in that country. Already the heat came harder each day. We had drawn ammunition. That fact put a sharper edge on all our waiting. A man may wait for transportation and still think himself a traveler. A man who has drawn ammunition knows he is being made ready for something more than travel. There were prayer meetings in camp, and I was thankful for them. They did not remove the heat, the uncertainty, or the sound of men coughing in the night, but they gave shape to the hours. I had trusted God before the war, and had no other trust after putting on the uniform. Faith in camp is not a separate country. It stands among cartridge boxes, stacked muskets, muddy shoes, and men who may be called away before the next evening's meeting. I helped all I could in the cause of Christ, because a soldier's soul needs tending as surely as his body does. New Orleans itself had shown me another face of the South before the Red River did. With William Elliott, I had managed a pass and gone to send the box. While out, we looked around us. The streets were narrow, most of them, but clean, and there were wider streets where cars ran under lines of trees. The trees gave a cooling effect to everything around. Squares were filled with walks, shrubs, shade, and flowers. Roses and violets were in full blow. A man could stand in such a city and almost forget that upriver an army had just been cut and driven back. Almost, but not quite. News came into camp as it always did, in pieces. Mansfield and Pleasant Hill had already been fought. The men who had seen those days were not yet my comrades in the full sense, but their wounds and words reached us before their hands did. The 13th Corps had been struck hard. The army had gone up the Red River with a great purpose and was now coming back under pressure. The Confederates under Richard Taylor had fought at Mansfield on the 8th and again at Pleasant Hill on the 9th. Banks had retreated. Men spoke of it with bitterness, and the bitterness did not sound like ordinary complaint. It sounded like soldiers believing their lives had been handled poorly. I had not been there. That must be said and kept plain. I did not see the pine woods near Mansfield. I did not see the road jammed with wagons. I did not see the line fold under attack, nor the men of other regiments taken off toward prison in Texas. I learned those things as a man coming late learns disaster, from the mouths of those who had passed through it, and from the silence of those who could not speak of it without stopping. Peter LaFlower's name carried the disaster home to Portage. He was not a place on a map or a number in a return. He was one of ours. Robert's survival carried mercy in the same way. The army may count killed, wounded, missing, and captured in columns. A wife waits for one name. A company remembers one face at a time. When the order came for us to move toward the Red River, the camp changed its sound. Men who had been lying in shade rose and shook themselves into readiness. Blanket rolls were tightened, canteens filled, cartridge boxes checked. Officers moved with papers and voices. The talk grew shorter. A man could feel the difference between rumor and motion. Rumor circles, motion points. We were to go by water again. But this was not the Mississippi journey south from Cairo. This was movement toward the war itself. The Mississippi had carried us like a great road. The Red River would be narrower, more uncertain, and already full of trouble. Its water was falling, though I did not yet understand how much would hang on that fact. Rivers had seemed to me like powers greater than men, but in Louisiana, even a river could fail an army at the hour it was most needed. The boat that carried us toward the Red River took on men, arms, stores, and that mixture of haste and delay that belongs to military transport. A gangplank becomes a test of patience when 100 men must cross it with muskets, blankets, haversacks, and orders shouted over steam. The deck filled with bodies and gear. Someone cursed the heat. Someone asked whether the regiment was at Alexandria. Someone else said the army had fallen back past there already. Another man said no one knew anything. All three may have been right in their own way. The engine took hold, and New Orleans began to fall behind us. The letter to Janet was somewhere in the great machinery of mail, and I was somewhere in the machinery of the army. I had written that I would send word every chance I got. Already I knew how few chances a soldier controls. We went first by the Mississippi, then toward the mouth of the Red River. The country changed as the boat moved. The banks were lower in places, the growth thick, the air close. There were trees standing in wet ground, driftwood caught in bends, muddy landings, and now and then signs of war along the water. Transports, gunboats, soldiers on shore, smoke beyond the trees, abandoned or damaged places whose full story no passing man could know. The river did not tell its meaning plainly. It carried us through it. The first sight of the Red River was the sight of a road not made by men, and yet crowded by men's designs. The water had a color and character of its own. It did not have the breadth or majesty of the Mississippi, but it held the army's fate more tightly. Its bends concealed what lay ahead. Its banks came close enough at times to make a man feel watched by the woods. A steamboat on such water seemed less like a vessel commanding the river, and more like a thing permitted to pass for the time being. We were going up while the army was coming down. That fact troubled the mind. I was moving toward men who had already been driven back. Every mile upstream felt like a question. What does a replacement bring to a regiment that has just buried friends, lost prisoners, cursed its generals, and come back from battle? A cartridge box, two hands, a body able to march. Perhaps that is enough in war. Perhaps it is all the army asks. The heat on the river was heavy, and the nights did not cool as Wisconsin nights do. Men slept on deck when they could. The engine's beat came through the boards. Mosquitoes found every place cloth did not cover. The smell of river mud and smoke entered the clothing. Food was eaten without ceremony. Coffee tasted of the vessel and the water. Men watched the banks and spoke less as we moved farther into the campaign's broken country. There were gunboats and transports to be seen or heard of, the Navy's iron weight in a river that was becoming too shallow for it. Admiral Porter's fleet had gone up with the campaign, and now the falling water threatened what the enemy had not yet taken. A gunboat looks powerful until one sees that it also needs depth beneath it. Iron and guns cannot argue with rock when water falls away. Word passed along the boat and at landings. Mansfield had been a hard defeat. Pleasant Hill had checked the enemy, yet the army retreated. Wagons had been lost. Men had been captured. The Confederates followed. Some spoke of General A.J. Smith's men as the ones who had saved the army from worse ruin. Some spoke of Banks in a tone that made respect impossible. I listened. A new man should listen more than he speaks, what the record does not say. I do not know the exact hour I first saw the 23rd Wisconsin as the regiment I was to belong to. The record gives the window, not the moment. But I know what it is to come upon men who have already been through what you have only imagined. They would not have looked like parade soldiers. The road and the river and the retreat would have marked them. Dust in the seams, faces thinned by heat and poor sleep, shirts dark with sweat, eyes that measured a new man quickly and did not hurry to welcome him. The living stood where the dead had left room. A company can receive a replacement and still be thinking of the man whose place he seems to fill. If Robert was there, then I would have looked first for the face that belonged to Janet's house as well as to the army. To tell a wife her brother lives is one thing. To stand before the man himself after the battle has spared him is another. I had come to join the regiment, but I had also come carrying home with me, and home had a name among those tired men. To join a regiment after a defeat is to enter a conversation already deep with grief. The 23rd Wisconsin was not a story beginning with me. It had wintered in Texas, moved through Louisiana, marched up with Banks, fought at Sabine Crossroads, fought again at Pleasant Hill, and come back toward Alexandria. The men had seen the campaign from the inside. I came to them from the rear, from camp, from transport, from letters, from rumor. The difference was plain. Some men are kind to replacements because they remember being green. Some are hard because they have paid for every inch of their knowledge and do not wish to hand it away cheaply. Some say little because the dead have taught them silence. I do not need to invent speeches for them. Their condition was speech enough. The regiment was tired, angry, and still under orders. Alexandria lay on the Red River, and by the time I was there, the army had gathered around it in a condition of suspense. The town was not merely a place on a map. It was a bottleneck of men, animals, wagons, boats, wounded, sick, officers, teamsters, contrabands, prisoners, rumors, and heat. The river that was supposed to carry the Navy was falling. The gunboats lay above the falls with too little water to pass safely below. The army could not simply leave them to the enemy, yet every day spent waiting gave the enemy more time to press. An army in retreat, but unable to retreat, is a dangerous thing to inhabit. Men feel the trap before they can describe it. The road to Shreveport had failed. The road back was not open until the river problem was solved. Supplies had to be managed. The wounded had to be cared for. Pickets watched the roads. Officers argued or planned. Soldiers waited and worked. Then came the dam. Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Bailey of the 4th Wisconsin Cavalry was not a man any of us had heard of before Alexandria. He had been born in Ohio, raised in Illinois, and settled in Kilburn City on the Wisconsin River as a lumberman. His knowledge had not come from West Point. It had come from the logging country, where he had built wing dams to drive lumber down the rivers of central Wisconsin. He was a man who had stood in cold water in his own life and made the river do what he needed it to do. The proposal was this. The gunboats lay above the falls at Alexandria with too little water to pass. The river was falling daily. Without intervention, the fleet would be lost, and what could not be saved would have to be destroyed by its own crews to keep it out of Confederate hands. Bailey proposed to build a dam across the Red River, raise the water at the falls by several feet, and float the gunboats over. The work of a lumberman applied to a navy. Admiral Porter, who commanded the fleet, met the proposal at first with the contempt that an old naval officer reserves for a Wisconsin volunteer, telling him how to save 10 gunboats. He was reported to have said the thing could not be done. He was not alone in saying so. The engineers of the regular army had their doubts. Officers of the Department of the Gulf had their doubts. The men in the ranks, when we heard of it, had our own opinion, which was that nothing else stood between the army and disgrace, and that a lumberman who said he could move water was at least a man with a plan when no one else had one. Bailey was patient and would not be moved. He argued the case in front of officers senior to himself, with diagrams and measurements and the memory of every Wisconsin River drive he had ever managed. General Banks, who had no better idea, authorized the work. The order went out on the 29th of April. The work was to begin the next morning. The detail was drawn from many regiments. The 23rd Wisconsin was named among them. So were Maine men, New York men, Iowa men, and a number of soldiers of African descent who had come to the army as workers and now took up the heaviest of the labor. The Maine men were lumbermen themselves and worked with the practiced motion that says, "A man knows his tool." The Iowa men were prairie farmers and had to be taught the axe by the cord. The black soldiers worked the longest hours and were given the worst of the assignments, and they did the work. And there is no honest account of what was done at Alexandria that does not begin with them. I had handled timber on a Wisconsin farm. I had cut wood for the stove and split rails for fence. I had not built a dam across a river running 10 miles an hour under a Louisiana sun. There is a difference between the wood of a quiet northern lot and the wood of a Red River cottonwood standing in heat that takes a man's strength before the axe is raised. The first day I was sent to fell timber on the bank, and by noon my shirt was wet through and my hands had blistered and the blisters had broken. By evening I had a respect for Bailey I had not had in the morning. He had asked of us only what he himself had done before the war for a living, and he had been right that it could be done. The cost of doing it was a different question. The structure took shape day by day, slowly at first, then with the kind of speed that comes when many hands learn the same work together. From the north shore, Bailey ordered a wing dam built of cribs of cross-laid logs filled with stone, brush, and earth. The cribs were great square frames of logs, notched at the corners as a man would notch a log cabin, only larger, and then weighted down with whatever heavy thing the country could supply. Stone was hauled from the riverbed. Brush was cut from the woods. Earth was carried in barrels. The cribs were set in the river and filled until they sank to the bottom and stood as a wall against the current. From the south shore, Bailey ordered a series of smaller bracket dams, set at angles to the main wing, to narrow the channel and force the water to rise. In the central gap between the two shores, four coal barges from the army supply train were sunk on purpose. They were filled with stone and timber and made part of the wall. A coal barge is not a building material in any ordinary sense. At Alexandria in May of 1864, it became one. The country supplied what the country had. Local cotton presses, abandoned by their owners or seized by the army, were torn down for their bolts and their heavy timbers. Houses in the town were dismantled for boards and beams. A man might walk through Alexandria in those weeks and see a porch where there had been a wall, or a wall where there had been a porch, or nothing at all where there had been a building the week before. The army was not gentle with the place. The army was doing what it had been told to do. The work went on through the night by torchlight. A river dam cannot be built only in daylight, because the river does not rest in the dark. Shifts rotated. Men who had stood waist-deep in the current for 4 hours came out shaking with cold under their wet shirts, even in the heat of a Louisiana May, and ate what was put in front of them and lay down where they could, and rose again when their names were called. The blistered hands healed only enough to be opened again the next day. The shoulders strained against timber that did not know it was being lifted. Mosquitoes rose from the still pools along the bank and worked us with the same patience the river current did. There were snakes in the brush. There were Confederate cavalry scouts on the far side of the river who fired across the water often enough to make a man notice them and seldom enough to make him think the danger was great. The greater danger was the heat. Men collapsed from it. Men were carried away to shade. Some of them came back the next day, and some did not. Bailey moved among us. He was not a colonel who watched from a tent. He stood in the river himself, in mud to his knees, and showed a private how a crib was to be notched, and a sergeant how a barge was to be filled, and a captain where a wing was to be carried out farther into the current. He carried the proposal in his own body. A man who has watched his own design fail can grow afraid of it. Bailey was not afraid of his design. He believed it would work because he had done the same kind of work many times in another country, and that belief carried us when our own strength would not have carried us. The water rose. Slowly at first, then by inches we could measure each morning against a stick driven into the bank. By the 8th of May, the gunboats above the falls had 3 feet more water beneath them than they had had on the 30th of April. The current at the dam itself was tremendous. The river was being held back where it had not been held back in any year of its history, and it complained against the dam with a sound a man could hear from a quarter mile away. In the early morning of the 9th of May, before the sun was fully up, the central part of the dam gave way. One of the coal barges, undermined by the current, broke from its place and was carried down the river. A second barge followed. The water that the dam had been holding back rushed through the gap in a sound that I do not have the words for. A river that has been gathered up and then released is not the same river it was before. It came through the broken place with the weight of 9 days of work behind it. Porter understood at once what had happened and what could yet be saved. He gave the order, before the water dropped fully, for the USS Lexington to make a run for it. The Lexington was the lightest of the trapped gunboats. Her pilot saw his chance and took it. She came down the river at full steam, struck the falls, and went over them in a moment that the men on the bank would not forget. The cheer that went up from the army was not the kind of cheer a man makes for a parade. It was the cheer a man makes when he sees a thing succeed that he had not been sure could succeed. It came from soldiers, from sailors on the other boats, from contrabands working the banks, from the men on the dam who had built what had broken and what had also worked. The Lexington escaped. 9 gunboats still lay above the falls. The dam was broken. The water was falling again. The work began over again that same morning. Bailey did not stop to mourn his dam. He ordered new wing dams built at the upper falls, above where the first dam had broken, to gather the water again at a higher point. The men were exhausted past the ordinary meaning of the word, and they took up the axes and the timber and the stone and built the second dams in 4 days. The 23rd Wisconsin worked with the rest. There is a kind of obedience that goes beyond drill. It is the obedience of men who have already given everything and find that more is required and give it anyway. The water rose again. Between the 11th and the 13th of May, the remaining gunboats came down one and two at a time. The Neosho, the Fort Hindman, the Osage, the Mound City, the Pittsburgh, the Carondelet, the Louisville, the Chillicothe, the Ozark. Each one came over the falls with the army watching from both banks, and each one drew a cheer that did not grow smaller as the gunboats came. The cheering at the end was as great as the cheering at the beginning. By the evening of the 13th, the fleet was below the falls. Porter's ironclads were saved. The dam had done what Bailey had said it would do. The work of lumbermen, applied to a navy, had carried out an army's mistake before that mistake became a national catastrophe. I do not know how to describe the feeling of standing on the bank while the last gunboat passed. A man may have many feelings at once and not be able to name any of them clearly. I knew that my own hands had helped to build what was now being praised. I knew that the praise belonged to Bailey and to the Navy that had agreed at last to try, and to the army that had labored. I knew also that none of those names would belong to any single man if any one of them had not been there. The work had been a work of many hands.
Looking back from the diary Edward bound at 70, the years take much from a man, and they take more than he thought they would. They take the names of horses he has owned, and the faces of men he has worked beside, and the order in which the children learned their letters and the smell of a particular spring, but they did not take the dam. The dam stood in my memory as it stood in the river, longer than I would have predicted on the day it was finished. I have wondered why. It was not the only labor of my service, nor the heaviest, nor the one closest to death. I was not at Mansfield. I was not at Pleasant Hill. I did not lie in the line at Blakely as some of my comrades did. The dam at Alexandria was hot work and hard work, but not in the ordinary sense of soldiering, dangerous work, and yet it stayed. I think now it stayed because the work succeeded. A man who has spent any part of his life in a field knows that much of his labor goes into ground that gives back less than it takes. A crop fails, a barn burns, a horse goes lame. A man builds a fence and watches a flood take it. The dam at Alexandria succeeded. The gunboats passed. The fleet was not lost. What I had helped to do had been done, and the river itself bore witness to it for a time. Bailey is in the ground now, and so are most of the men I worked beside in that water. The dam itself was taken by the Red River the next year, as a dam in such a country must be. But there was a year when it stood, and a fleet that came through it, and a cheer from both banks that I can still hear in my mind. The Lord giveth a man, in the course of a life, a small number of moments in which his work counts plainly. The rest of the work counts also, but not plainly. I have been grateful for the dam more than for many things that ought by reason to have meant more to me.
Still, deliverance from the falls was not deliverance from the campaign. The army had not taken Shreveport. The enemy had not disappeared. The retreat to the Mississippi still lay before us. Alexandria was not a home, but a pause before more road, more heat, more skirmishing, more sickness, more uncertainty. The dam solved the river problem so that the army could move, and movement meant danger returning in its old shape. By the 12th of May, the waiting had changed again. The fleet had been saved. Orders and preparations pointed toward departure. Men packed what could be carried and abandoned what could not. The roads south and east waited. The Red River, which had carried me toward the regiment, would now be part of the story by which the regiment and army tried to get out. I had come to the war by rail and river, through camps and letters and rumors. At Alexandria, among the men of the 23rd Wisconsin, I was no longer only a man being sent to a regiment. I was in it. I had seen the Red River. I had seen the army caught by water and saved by labor. I had stood among men who carried Mansfield in their faces and Pleasant Hill in their anger. I had learned that war could be fought with a rifle, an axe, a rope, a shovel, a prayer, and a letter home. The order to move was near. The retreat itself was not yet begun, but every man could feel it gathering. The boats were below. The roads were before us. The enemy was not done. We waited for the march.